Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We'll continue with David Corton as he talks about the origins of money and its impact on our society.
Back when I was growing up, most of our financial institutions in the United States were community-based. There were community banks that had no branches. It's one single office of a bank owned by people in the community, takes deposits from the community, makes loans to businesses in the community like my family's business. Community banks, mutual savings and loans, which are really cooperatives, credit unions, which are also cooperatives, which means they're organized as non-profit cooperatives. Could you imagine a money system based primarily on institutions that are not private for-profit, but are actually managed by and for the community? To me, cooperatives are not a socialist institution. Cooperatives are actually, to me, the ultimate manifestation of a market economy. Part of a market is private ownership. Well, a cooperative means everybody owns something, has an ownership share. That's a pretty good idea. Now, what happened through deregulation? A piece of this financial system, of course, is I assume most of you realize that most of our money is created by banks when they issue a loan. And that capacity resided in the community, and it meant that you had institutions in a community that if you had opportunities in your community to connect unutilized resources with unmet needs, to invest in real productive capacity in your community, responsive to things that the community wanted and needed, you essentially created your own credit with those financial institutions to finance those activities. Now, over time through deregulation, we saw consolidation of those banks, mergers and acquisitions. Many of the community institutions were taken over and operated as private, publicly traded corporations. As the system shifted, it moved from providing real financial services to the community to concentrating the control, the power to create and allocate money in the institutions of Wall Street, totally removed from the community, totally unconcerned with productive activity, with the social or environmental consequences of how the money was used or the businesses were run, but concentrated in institutions that were able to create money from nothing to pump up financial bubbles, to engage in speculation, to create loan pyramids where banks loan back and forth to each other, create fictitious assets which become collateral for more lending and so forth, so that you get more and more what I call phantom wealth accumulating in these hands of these institutions that are totally undemocratic, totally unaccountable to any human interest other than, quite frankly, not even the interest of their shareholders who might be pensioners and so forth and pension funds that own some of these funds, but predominantly to their own managers who are managing these institutions to maximize their own bonuses. That's part of the perversion of what's happened. It's recognizing that money, this is another part of our illusion of the trance that we're in. We are conditioned to believe that money is wealth. And if you believe that money is wealth, it's very easy to believe that people who are creating money are creating wealth. Now, when this process is simply going on within these Wall Street institutions, there is no real wealth creation. It is simply a process of creating more and more of these accounting chits, which gives their holders more and more claim on the real resources of the rest of society, to say nothing of more and more control over our politicians who write the rules and then are directed to write the rules that further facilitate this process of fraud and corruption. So you begin to get a picture of why these institutional issues of institutional design, how we really structure our economic institutions, how we structure our money system, is extraordinarily significant to all the problems we see in society. Because if you understand the dynamics of this money system and how it plays out through global corporations and our other economic institutions, you understand why our financial system is inherently unstable, moves inevitably through cycles of boom and bust, currently is propped up solely by public subsidies, why that system creates an imperative for the larger economy, as we measure by GDP, to continuously expand, why that system inexorably drives ever faster environmental destruction, why every day more and more wealth concentrates in the hands of fewer and fewer people, why our institutions are losing legitimacy, the social fabric is disintegrating, and our political system is becoming ever more corrupt. Okay, so that's a pretty discouraging picture, and I realize I've kind of probably leaving my notes. You know, I get a little deeper into some of these things. So at this point, you're probably thinking, gee, so what's the answer? The answer starts with a conversation. It starts with a conversation to change the framing stories of our culture by which we understand the purpose of the economy, our human nature, the possibilities to design our economic institutions in a different way, by which we understand what we really value, understand our human nature. Are we truly just greedy, individualistic, or were we in fact, did we evolve to live in community? You know, and the answers to that are pretty simple. I mean, you think about it. Are most of the people you know evil, violent, greedy, individualistic? Or do you have some friends that are really pretty decent folks who really care about the world, who you can count on? Yeah. That's nice, isn't it? And you know, that's the way most people are. That really is our human nature. And you know, the truth is, yeah, there are some really evil, angry, individualistic, greedy, untrustworthy, violent people in our world. You step back and you realize these are the psychologically disturbed. These are the people who are in deep trouble. These are people who need help. These are people who should perhaps be in some sort of mental institution rather than running our political organizations and our corporations. Maybe went a little further there than I should. But that's part of waking up to the reality. It's part of changing the story. So this is so fascinating to me. The first step toward deep change is a new story. Talk to your friends about money, about the money system, about money as a system of power. Talk to them about these questions of what is our true human nature, what is our possibility as a species to rediscover our true humanity, rediscover what it means to be a healthy human being, rediscover the fact that we evolved to live in community and in fact cannot survive outside of community, and that from all the things we know from our studies of public health, the stronger our communities, the more equitable our societies, the healthier people are physically and mentally, the happier they are, the more democratic our societies, the more creative people are. This is a possibility. This is what we can be. Second, we create a new reality from the bottom up. Charles asked how many people are eating food out of their garden. You know, when I grew up, my grandparents had gardens and we raised chickens and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And then we kind of moved away from that, most of us. One of the groups that I'm deeply involved in is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And you have a network of Business Alliance for Local Living Economies here in Vancouver. This is an organization that's working with communities throughout Canada and the United States, rebuilding our local economies based on local businesses, rebuilding our local food systems, our local building systems, our local financial systems, our local information systems, which is all about restoring our control over our economy and at the same time doing it in a way that is rebuilding the relationships of community. That's all about creating this new reality from the bottom up. The third critical element in the change strategy is change the rules. Ultimately, we've got to get back control of our politics. So we write the rules in ways that favor real democracy, real community control, more moving back toward more local self-reliant economies that are engaged in real investment, creating real wealth. in contrast to the rules that we have now that generally favor the ever greater concentration of economic power in financial institutions that are simply engaged in creating phantom wealth to increase their control over the resources of the rest of the society. Now, this change is happening, the awakening is happening, it is all happening at a blinding rate. Another of my activities is Yes Magazine. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with Yes Magazine, which we published down on Bainbridge Island in Puget Sound? You know, we're about yesmagazine.org. Take a note of that, because if you're ever feeling a little hopeless and a little glum, go to our website or subscribe to the magazine, and it's just filled with the stories of the people who are creating this new reality and doing it on an increasingly significant scale. This is not marginal activity anymore. This is the creation of the new mainstream, but you don't read about it in the conventional media. There is hope. To me, it is extraordinarily exciting. We, as I briefly mentioned, we've been organizing around dominator hierarchies for some 5,000 years. If you look at the earliest societies, they were built around community. They were built around connection to the earth. They were built around a deep spirituality. Many of those who study this earlier period believe that they were based generally on gender equality, that they were largely nonviolent. But then some 5,000 years ago, we moved into an era of empire, and we started to create these dominator systems, and we started to divide ourselves into dominator pyramids with a few people on top, most people on the bottom, which then puts us all into a position of competition for the privileged positions, and it makes a huge difference whether you're on the top or the bottom. And then that plays out in sexism and racism, classism, all the other isms. But we're now beginning to develop the communications capability to communicate directly with one another, to break through these illusions, to share the truth with one another, and to begin to organize from the bottom to create this new reality, to take back our lives, and to carry forward what I think of as the great democratic experiment of moving to a position of true popular sovereignty.
Radio EcoShock.
You have been listening to David Korten, author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, recorded at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, on September 27, 2010. The UBC REITS Sustainability Program is bringing in some great speakers to stimulate students and staff. They also recorded Stuart Brand in a speech on October 5th. Find links to all that as free MP3 audio in my EcoShock blog entry for this show. Just click blog at ecoshock.org. My thanks to Justin and the whole crew at UBC for sharing these fine speakers. Stuart Brand says we must concentrate people in cities and energy from sources like nuclear power. The corporate world is also concentrating our food system with dangerous results. In the news, at least five big supermarket chains recalled millions of eggs due to salmonella poisoning. The big shock for many of us? All those eggs came from a single Midwest farm. How precarious our food supply is now that farming has morphed into industrial mega machinery. The new word we have to learn, CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. EarthAware publishers have just brought out two new books on the tragedy of industrial animal factories. There is a CAFO reader and a big, big book of companion photos that could frighten you. Here to talk about it is Daniel Imhoff, editor of both.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, you've written books like Food Fight, Farming with the Wild, but this project must have been very tough to document, was it?
Absolutely. I've been a researcher and writer, independent publisher, for about 20 years, and normally my approach is to take a very urgent issue and explain it rather quickly but in a deep context, and then spend most of my time really assessing and featuring solutions to that problem. But CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, it's for the most part a book that is trying to give something that most people don't have, which is a behind-the-scenes look at industrial animal agriculture, where our meat and our poultry and milk products are increasingly produced, and it is not a pretty picture.
I want to take a second because I had a striking personal reaction to these images taken from our mass food system, and I can only tell it like this. You know, when I was 10, looking through my grandfather's bookshelf, I pulled down a scary book. It was filled with photographs from the Holocaust, the industrial slaughter of human beings. No one had told me about it, and those images never left me. And I had a similar reaction when I got your big book of photos and essays on these animal farms. It was filled with stuff we never see in the mainstream media, a hidden sort of animal holocaust, if you will, and it made me feel sick. How are we going to overcome our aversion, the fact that we don't want to know, the fear and the nausea that we're afraid of, when we confront the realities of massive animal suffering that is happening in our names?
Well, I was thinking that we might have had a kind of a warning page, a cautionary warning, right as you open the book that says, warning, this book contains explicit photographs of food production. You know, I don't know how you break down this ethical barrier and this reaction to, this defensive reaction to not want to see how the animals are treated that we depend upon for food. If our pets were treated the same way, we certainly would be very concerned, and we would want to see, and we would want to know, and actually we would probably want to persecute. And so somehow, because this is becoming the increasingly dominant way that we're producing food animals, not just here, but in other parts of the world as well, and because the costs of this food production system are becoming more and more obvious, it's just something that we're going to have to know. We're going to have to take the time if we want to have a healthy world. And a healthy world, I mean a healthy food system, vibrant farm economies, and healthy rural environments where people who are farming and who are living in the country, you know, actually depend on a sane environment to live their lives.
Well, some really good writers are speaking out about this. Tell us about some of the authors in these CAFO books.
Well, I read dozens and dozens of books when the assignment first came to my desk. And really, since 2000, there have been so many great books that either are focused on this topic or are partially focused on this topic. And so I had a wide range of voices to choose from. I didn't want it to be seen as a vegan or slow food or, you know, simply a sustainable agriculture lens which we're looking at the issue through. So there are 30 different voices in the big book. They include farmers, ranchers, chefs. One author, Matthew Scully, is a former speechwriter for a Republican president, George W. Bush. Then we have really prominent writers who've been writing about food and agriculture for a long time, like Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan. But then we have research organizations, the Center for a Livable Future in the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and also fellows who participated in the Pew Commission report on industrial animal agriculture. So, I mean, you've got this wide, wide range of voices reporting.
How big are concentrated animal feeding operations?
Well, they're big. They're huge. They produce obscene amounts of waste, and they're getting bigger. It's not uncommon for a cattle feedlot to hold 100,000 cattle at any one time. These broiler sheds, these windowless barns where they grow meat chickens, hold 20 to 30,000 chickens. You can have 80,000 hens or more in a single building, 1,000 full-grown pigs, hogs, in a hog barn where, you know, these animals are not being exposed to the open air, scratching in the dirt, and really living the kind of life that they're used to. The modus operandi of a CAFO, of a concentrated animal feeding operation, is pretty simple. You concentrate as many animals as you can in the smallest area possible, and you feed them a diet that makes them gain weight as quickly as possible for the least amount of cost. And oftentimes what you have is just a life that is short and miserable and nowhere near the life that that particular species was born to lead.
This is Radio EcoShock talking with Daniel Imhoff, editor of two new books on industrial animal factories. Daniel, start us through the food chain. What are the ecological risks involved with getting the feed for all these animals to fatten them up?
It is sometimes brought up that we have so few farmers today so that we're all freed up to, we other citizens are freed up to do other things in the economy. But what we have is farmers producing vast amounts of feed to fatten animals in confinement. The key driver of that industrial grain is corn and soy and hay, and among them, those big three, they occupy hundreds of millions of acres of the American landscape, particularly corn and soy. Their yields are maximized with heavy applications of fertilizers, and oftentimes they're cultivated with herbicides, pesticides. Their cultivation is dependent upon water. And in cultivation, we also have some pretty severe and continuous impacts on the soil. We're losing a lot of our best soil. We have a feeding system that is highly industrialized. It's dependent upon fossil fuel inputs. And many argue that it's really not sustainable for the long term. So the question about how can we feed the world, I think we also have to look at how can we feed the world, especially because we're using so much of the world's resources to produce feed to then feed to animals in confinement.
In another part of that food chain, the government here runs big billboards telling people to wash their hands with common soap. Antibacterial soap, they say, is leading to antibiotic-resistant bacteria. But I don't see any big ads warning me about the load of antibiotics in meat production. How bad is that?
Well, if you talk to the researchers at Johns Hopkins Medical School, they will tell you that we're very close to squandering human antibiotic medicines, which many have proclaimed as the greatest medical discovery of the last 500 years. Antibiotics are routinely fed to animals in CAFOs, basically as a means of life support to keep them alive in these rather gruesome conditions, especially because they're eating such a high-octane diet to put on protein as fast as possible rather than growing more slowly in appropriate numbers in far different conditions than, you know, being stuck in cages or pens or windowless barns. And when you look at the numbers, the state of North Carolina, CAFOs in the state of North Carolina apply more antibiotic medicines on animal food production than all of human consumption of antibiotic medicines. And it's the same with the state of Iowa as well. And what you find is they're using many of the same penicillin and tetracycline antibiotics in animal production as we depend on in human production. And the real scare there is that this overdosing of antibiotics in animal factories is potentially creating these super resistant strains of diseases that could affect us. And then we're going to be powerless, really, to defend ourselves against them.
You mentioned our pets. The Humane Society goes after people who mistreat them. Don't we have laws in North America to protect farm animals, and how do our laws compare with what's going on in Europe?
I think Europe is ahead of our laws. Ironically, when it comes to livestock, the greatest protection that they're afforded is under the Humane Slaughter Act, which says that they can't be slaughtered when they're conscious. The big loophole in the Humane Slaughter Act is that it doesn't apply to birds. And, you know, out of the 10 billion animals that are slaughtered each year in the United States for food, not including fish, 9 billion of them are meat chickens. And so our greatest by number food item is exempted from the Humane Slaughter Act. What we do find is that for many decades now, European countries have been very concerned about certain production methods, banning of extreme confinement methods, searching for better ways, looking for better ways for slaughter. And I really, truly think it's time that we, USDA, we as a society, if the federal government isn't acting, then as state governments we might act, to adopt the best practices that are really out there in the world. And then, you know, to really rely on the amazing resources that we have, that the human resources that we have addressing this issue, like, you know, Temple Grandin at Colorado State University, who she deserves a huge department of people working under her with some kind of visionary program for productive, safe, clean, affordable animal food products for the next 30 to 50 years, something truly visionary.
Dan, could you give us just a couple of tips on what we can do as consumers to help reshape that food system?
You can work on so many levels, from the very, very personal home level to schools and businesses, and then on to political, local, regional, state, national political levels. You can vote with your fork. You can really see your food purchases as this very active way that you participate in the world around you, on the land, in terms of how plants and animals are produced and how the people who raise them are treated. And I think you can also do a good deal of research in your own region, and there's great books out there. If you're not familiar with the issue, certainly the CAFO and CAFO Reader are a good start, but I think you can make your own manifesto, your own eating manifesto, about what you feel about animal products, that maybe you want to buy the best quality that you can and learn to make the most of those products and to really honor them. But then also, whenever there's an election coming up, and at whatever level, I believe that there is a very important place for all the issues related to food production to be on anyone's platform. They are just that important. If we as a country were to make a healthy food system one of our driving economic goals, I think we would have a far different economy and society and future ahead of us.
I know the big meat producers are very protective. They're well hidden from view. They've got security systems. They've got laws in the United States that define somebody coming in to take pictures as some sort of agricultural terrorism. So how did you come across these images of gigantic production and the animal suffering?
Well, that's a really good question. We started with 6,000 photographs, and in getting down to the large photo format book, we selected 450. The majority of those photographs came from, or at least the largest number, came from news agencies, from Associated Press and Reuters and photographer agencies like Corbis and newspapers, the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune, Charlotte Observer. These were photographers that were granted access. Any food journalist who wants to go visit a CAFO has a very difficult time getting in. And so we really relied on and purchased a lot of photos from photographers who were given releases to be on those premises. And then you have numerous groups around the country, dozens of groups, amazing organizations who have been fighting this expansion of CAFOs in their communities for many decades. And
well, that's why these books have to get out, people. The CAFO Reader, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories, and the companion photo book are lasting tools for activists, I think. Act to change it as you can. My thanks to Daniel Imhoff in Northern California.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That is all the time we have, and thank you for listening.